Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese of Vanderbilt. In our bi-monthly podcasts, we interview philosophers about their new books in ethics, metaphysics, political philosophy, philosophy of mind, epistemology, and many other areas. Today's interview is with Michael Marder, Ikerbasque Research Professor of Philosophy at the University of the Basque Country in the Basque Autonomous Region of Spain. We're talking about his new book, Plant Thinking, A Philosophy of Vegetal Life, just out from Columbia University Press. If animals have suffered marginalization throughout the history of Western thought, then non-human, non-animal living beings, such as plants, have populated the margin of the margin, a zone of absolute obscurity in which their mode of existence, from a philosophical perspective, is not even question-worthy. So writes Marder in the start of his new book, Plant Thinking, a book in which the metaphor of groundbreaking has actually never been so apt. Contrasting his view with the Aristotelian perspective, in which plants are basically defective animals, Marder initiates inquiry into the nature of vegetal life on its own terms, and into how human life currently encounters, and how it should encounter, this radically foreign mode of existence. Marder's goal is nothing less than a sort of Nietzschean revaluation of values when it comes to vegetal life. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Michael Marder.
Hello. Hello, Carrie.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you. It's very good to be talking to you, Carrie.
I'm very excited about talking about your new book, Plant Thinking, A Philosophy of Vegetal Life. This really is, I mean, the term groundbreaking has probably never been so apt, I think. And at the very beginning of the book, you sort of start out with a very apt quote, I thought, saying that if animals have suffered from marginalization throughout the history of Western thought, then non-human, non-animal living beings, such as plants, have populated the margin of the margin. This book, of course, is, as I understand it, aims to kind of upend that attitude and provide a sort of revaluation of the nature of plant life, and then, in consequence, our own relationship to plant life, vegetal life. So before we get into the book itself, it would be great if you could give us a little background on your own philosophical career and how you came to write this book.
Right. Thank you, Carrie. So at least as far as I can tell, and in these questions, sometimes an outside perspective is indispensable or even more important. There is no direct link between my earlier work in philosophy and my interest in plant life. My first book was a discussion of the notion of the thing in Derrida's Deconstruction, and I particularly worked there from the phenomenological perspective, even though it was not the traditional classical phenomenology, which is oriented toward human experience of the world. The second monograph was on the phenomenological, once again, and existential underpinnings of Carl Schmitt's political philosophy. And so much of my work until Plant Thinking has been situated at the intersection of phenomenology and political philosophy. But as I mentioned, this was not really a very traditional human-centered phenomenology. So what I found out from my study of Derrida's writings on the thing is that it turned out to be something very strange. It turned out to be neither animate nor inanimate. It kind of displayed an intentionality of its own and aimed at us while, before and after, we try to grasp it or try to direct ourselves to it. So it had to do quite a bit with the phenomenology of non-human existences, sometimes what we consider to be even inanimate existences. And so that led to a kind of broad interest in the intentionalities of other modes of existence and forms of life than our own. And of course, as we know, in contemporary philosophy, there has been much work done on animal life in the last couple of decades. work that has been groundbreaking and that has questioned many of the traditional sort of humanist orientations to what it means to be, to exist, to think, to experience, and so on. But my sense was that it's relatively easy to relate to animals based on a sort of sympathy, though we tend to sympathize or empathize with some animals and not others, that there is a distinction there. So all of this was in the back of my mind while I was reading an excellent book by Claudia Baracchi titled Aristotle's Ethics as First Philosophy. Mm-hmm. And when it came to Baracchi's discussion of the vegetal soul, it suddenly occurred to me that this was a mode of subjectivity very much ignored in recent philosophical discussions. So we moved through a kind of broad questioning of humanism, of the meaning of a purely human subjectivity, to asking what exactly can we really say about something like animal subjectivity, but the subjectivity of plants, which would be a kind of corollary to or the corresponding notion to Aristotle's vegetal soul, has not really been discussed. And so that that was the impetus, the sort of theoretical impetus that I received to carry out this work. Of course, the persistent and deepening environmental crisis is an ever-present reality for us, and I think there is a kind of ethical obligation for philosophers to respond to it thinkingly. For me, both this crisis and the very term environment are too big and too unwieldy and too abstract somehow. And so when we talk about the environment, we create a kind of totality and abstraction from which we are quite distanced. So and plants are much more concrete than that. They can, I think, act as concrete entry points into the environment and what it means to be in the environment. So that was another consideration as I was beginning this work, that we could respond to the environmental crisis starting from the figure of the plant that is a much more concrete and manageable entry point into this set of issues, at least to my mind.
So you... one of the ways that you describe your approach, I mean, this, you mentioned Aristotle, and there is there's sort of two questions. I'll ask them, you know, one at a time, I guess, starting with the Aristotle question. So for a lot of philosophers, at least, you know, questions about the nature or the being of plants, really is, you know, just what Aristotle says and, you know, the nutritive soul. And
right.
So one of the things that would help to kind of start us off would be to contrast to describe the, as you put, the violence that Aristotle's thought has unleashed, you know, on plants, and to describe the point of view from which, you know, we sort of see plants as defective animals, as you put it. If you could describe that framework that you are, that you're responding to.
Right. So I completely agree with you, Carrie, that Aristotle's is probably the best known conceptualizations of plant life. But that's not to say that other thinkers throughout the tradition of Western philosophy did not consider vegetal beings on the, let's say, on the margins of their texts. And it is also true that they position themselves in one way or another vis-a-vis Aristotle. For the most part, they sort of place themselves as they accepted his basic tenets. So they simply developed a little bit further his theory. And the example that comes to mind is, for instance, Avicenna, who spun elaborate hierarchies out of the simple structure, let's say, of Aristotle's vegetal soul or totreptikon, which for him included simply the capacities for nourishment and reproduction. Right. And then as we move closer to our period in the philosophical history, and especially toward the 19th and 20th century, there is a turn to a more unexpected, I would say, twist on the Aristotelian insights. And I'm thinking in particular of Nietzsche, for instance, who in his own notion of the will to power relies, whether consciously or not, on these capacities for nourishment and reproduction, along with growth, to develop his own basic ontology. So that's to say that Aristotle has been, I agree with you, a completely insuperable figure, I would say, in the history of Western thought when it comes to plants, but also when it comes to many other things. Now, to be fair to Aristotle, I would not want to dismiss him altogether. And in fact, I think that he displays a kind of crucial ambiguity on the subject of plant life. So let's take the positive side first, maybe. Aristotle tells us that there is no life, no animation of matter and so on, without the vegetal foundation for this kind of a movement, without Dothrepticon. So, which means that to think life, be it the life of animals or of humans or of anything whatsoever, is necessarily to think of plants and something else in addition, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of the foundation for all thinking of life is plant life. He made it absolutely essential. But on the more shadowy side of his philosophy, this is where we come to the issue that you are raising, Kerry. Aristotle dismisses these capacities of plants, which to be sure are indispensable and which we share with them. He dismisses them as the more basic, as capacities that are more basic and less developed than those of animals and humans. And so as a result, for him, plants become deficient animals that are tethered to the ground through their roots, that are defenseless, exposed, dependent, and so on. And what happens as a result is that plants and animals become grouped under the same category of a living thing, zoon in Greek, and humans are, of course, understood as political or rational animals. So the living thing is the animal, the plant is a kind of deficient animal, mm-hmm. and humans are political or rational animals. But the deficiency, where does the deficiency lie here? It's, I think, in the fact that for Aristotle, the plant is an animal minus locomotion and sensation. So it's like an animal, but what makes it unique are these deficiencies, are these lacks that other animals do not really display. And I think that what I zero in on in plant thinking is this minus, is this negativity that has been that has determined our attitude toward plants for millennia now. So that they have been these figures of lack of sensitivity, lack of motion. It's always under the sign of lack and minus that they are understood. And I think that Aristotle is to a large part to blame for that.
So in contrast to this, I mean, in the first part of the book, you mm-hmm. look at various ways in which vegetal life is different from animal life in a positive mm-hmm. manner, not as a lack, but as, you know, these are certain ways of you know, in the Nietzschean way, revaluing the aspects of plant life that are just, they're just radically different. They're not lacking. They're just different. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of these different features, you know, that you mentioned, and I thought it would be great if you could give us a sample of some of the most important ones. As I went through, I was looking through. You have, you know, the pattern of growth is different. The infiniteness of growth, the headlessness of plants, their radical dependence on the other. And so on. Mm-hmm. So I'll let you choose sort of which of those features mm-hmm. you think would be most important to kind of to outline for us.
Right. Yes. So all of these are features that are definitive of the plant's mode of being. But if I were to forced to choose probably the most remarkable of these features that actually reunites many of the others under the same umbrella, I would have to say that it's the plant's modular growth and development. Modular growth and development. And what that means is that plants grow by replicating already existing structures. It's fairly easy to grasp this. Plants grow by branching out, and so they repeat the leaves and the branches and all of these the architecture as it were, of the plant is an infinite or seemingly infinite replication. And of course, those plants that do not have access to sexual means of reproduction reproduce through clonal development, right, which is the mechanism for growth and reproduction alike in these kinds of plants. And so this is, I think, for me, this is the crucial point where plants differ from most animals, and indeed from anything that develops as an organism. I would be very reluctant, in fact, I would be opposed to calling plants organisms, because an organism is essentially a totality, right? Mm-hmm. So in an organism, the organs do not have any sort of independence. They are subordinate to the whole. And not only that, but most of the parts of the organism are already there in nutri before the animal is even born. So it's all sort of anticipated. And this is how we tend to think of a concept in Aristotle or Hegel as well. It's a kind of organismic thing where even before the concept is developed, its many facets are already there as abstract possibilities. Now, a plant, of course, has its own genetic makeup as well, but the concrete shape that it takes as in the end of its or throughout its growing, in the course of its growth, very much depends on the environmental circumstances. And we could think of the neighboring species that determine to what extent a plant would thrive, the amount and the angle of sunlight, the distribution of the minerals in the soil, and so on. Why do I think that this difference is so important, aside from the fact that it does not follow this organismic development of animals? I think it's because if you, let's say you're fond of technological or informatic analogies, then we could say that the plant's modular structure, or what plant scientists themselves now refer to as modular intelligence, is like parallel processing reiterated manifold. So it's like each branch and offshoot and even a leaf is similar to a highly sensitive antenna that catches environmental signals. The function is replicated, so there is no novelty there. It is a kind of infinite replication of the function. And then, of course, the question is, what about central processing of information, right? Because plant scientists are very much enamored with the cognitive and especially computational models of thinking about plants. And their next question is, there is this dispersed modular intelligence, but is it processed centrally? And this is a great enigma in the plant sciences themselves nowadays. So it seems that there is some central processing, but the exact mechanism has not really been pointed out yet. And there are some hunches whether it's hormonal flows in the plant or even long distance electrical signaling, but no one really knows what that central processing is and whether it actually exists. And I think that even if such a mechanism for central processing of information existed, it's obvious that plants are highly decentralized living beings, and this modular kind of development highlights that for us. And that there are parts that are exactly not organs, as I like to reiterate, are much more prepared to lead independent existence if they are severed from the whole, which is not really the case, of course, with animal organs. And this has already been known, at least in the 19th century, when plants were described as loose assemblages or almost societies of living beings that could be severed from one another without inflicting irreparable harm, either on the whole or on the member that is severed. So just to conclude this line of thinking, I would say that this modular development in an animal would have been taken as a sign of something monstrous. Mm-hmm. If we imagine an organ or a series of organs replicated by branching out infinitely, it would be really, in an animal, it would be a monstrosity. But in a plant, this is the way that plants live. This is the way they reproduce and grow. And this is the way they interact with the environment as well.
And then how about another aspect that you also emphasized was the the radical dependence and the different sort of dependence, I suppose, of plants on what surrounds them, on their environment. Could you say something about that as well?
Yes, certainly. When it comes to animals, most of them that are not sessile animals that can move by changing place, they can flee from dangers, right? And they can also move toward resources. If plants are really growing in the same place, even though they can modify that place in various ways, they have no such option to flee from danger or to move to dislocate themselves toward a place where resources are available. Of course, there are always exceptions. Actually, I'm just thinking about an example of a stilt palm, which in the course of its lifetime actually moves quite a bit. It grows new roots and then kills off a part of the trunk and then moves to with detecting areas where resources are richer in the soil and moves along. Hmm. Like that. So there are always exceptions. We can never generalize anything, especially in the case of plants, right? But this is the general cases that they cannot really oppose themselves to the environment in the way that an animal does by withdrawing from it. And so they have to work with the environment much more than animals, right? They have to as it were, grow with their environment and respond to challenges by, if not by fleeing, then by changing something, very often changing something in their own physiology or even morphology. So in that sense, Hegel was actually the thinker who paid the most attention to this feature of plant subjectivity, as he called it, because he said that plants lack the oppositional structure of subjectivity. They do not oppose their other. For him, that was a sign of that was a dead end, really, because to be a subject for Hegel is exactly to oppose the other, right? And then to overcome the opposition and move to the next stage and so on. Mm-hmm. With plants, insofar as there is no opposition to the other, they are just the very beginning of subjectivity, still very much bound to the inorganic world. Once again, this is a lack, this is a deficiency from the standpoint of traditional philosophy that we can think of as a newly gained strength for us from our contemporary perspective. And if we think of context-bound mode of thinking and relating to others that have flourished since the end of the 20th century in feminist thought, for instance, then we can really use plants as a model for this, because plants do not oppose their context. They work with their context and they're very much embedded in it. So we can also think of a less dominating, a less domineering aspect of human existence as embedded in its environment and working and evolving with it rather than opposing it.
By recognizing all these different, sort of very, very fundamental differences in the modes of being, could you perhaps say a bit more about how you think that, recognition of these differences can help lead to a revaluation of, of vegetal life and, I suppose, as you were just suggesting, of our own understanding of life and our relationship to the environment?
Yes, certainly. So I would say that the issues that were for Aristotle lacks and negativities become advantages from a standpoint of from a point of view that is no longer attached to traditional philosophy with its values of immutable being, of a kind of foundation for all being that is not really affected by anything in this world. So if we are thinking of finitude, for instance, and the positive revaluation of finitude in 20th century and 21st century philosophy, then the figure of the plant is indispensable here, especially because not only finitude in the sense of mortality, but the kind of growth that supplants the permanent and immutable foundation for being. I think we can certainly find that in plants. So in that sense, if the thinking of philosophical thinking after Western metaphysics, after the tradition of Western metaphysics that, let's say, culminated in Nietzsche, if it were to proceed by returning to nature, what we now reconceptualize to as nature, through the figure of the plant, then we can learn quite a bit from plants, from their non-oppositionality, from their permanent metamorphosis or growth, and plasticity, and all of these features that we have been discussing here.
One of the things you mentioned just a little while ago, and also somewhat in passing in various places in the book, was some of the empirical investigations into plant life, mm-hmm. you know, plant communication and the use of hormones and so forth. Did any of this research? To what extent did this research inform your own, you know, sort of more philosophical investigation or into the nature of plant life? I mean, was there anything that you got from that research that really guided you, or was it just did you sort of approach this from a, you know, from your own philosophical perspective, and then you kind of found empirical work that happened to apply to your own investigation?
Right. That's a very good question, Carrie. I think that as one delves into the research of contemporary plant science, it's really mind-boggling the capacities that the scientists themselves find in plants. And according to their own admissions, what we know about plants now from scientifically is a very minuscule sort of portion of what can be known about them, that we know maybe 2 or 3% of how plants actually work and their mode of living and so on. But I would say that their research has influenced me quite a bit, even though I came to it seeking only, as you said, the kind of confirmation of my own philosophical position. In the end, it ended up shaping my own thinking as well. So I think that the relation between my research and contemporary plant science is a kind of two-way street. And the way it worked is that I have been told by some plant scientists that I'm providing them with a kind of overarching theoretical framework that they have been lacking for their own empirical investigations. And I myself am drawing a kind of both an inspiration to further questioning of what plants are and what they can do, and evidence for my own philosophical position from them. Now, that's not to say that plant science is a kind of uniform field. In fact, for more than a decade, there have been very heated debates going on between plant scientists who investigate what they call plant intelligence and their more conventionally minded colleagues that deny the fact that plants are intelligent beings. Mm-hmm. And so I have been, of course, collaborating with the plant intelligence community, and I have received great feedback from them, and I've learned a lot from them at the same time.
Well, let me follow up on that. There's in the latter part of the book, you mm-hmm. you know, after sort of giving a kind of anti-metaphysical overview of, you know, of the nature of plant being and the radical differences between that mode of being and the mode of animals, mm-hmm. You go into three distinct perspectives on plants. One is what you call the time of plants, or another is the freedom of plants. And then the third is the wisdom of plants, which, you know, sort of gets directly to the idea of plant intelligence. And that's where you talk about, you know, plant thinking proper, as you put mm-hmm. it. But I thought each of those things was a very interesting meditation. So could you say a bit about the time of plants and the freedom of plants before we get to the wisdom of plants?
Mm. Right. Yes. So of course, I devote quite a bit of space to this in the book, and I can only highlight maybe some of the more interesting points from this discussion. Otherwise, we'll have an audio book and not an interview.
Right.
Here. But yes. So the time of plants. Of course, I think of it in as a kind of combination of three temporalities. In general, I claim that the time of plants is the time of the other. They are very much attuned to the change of seasons, for instance, to the external changes. And so they follow this temporality, let's say, of the world or of the planet in their own growth and reproductive cycles. In that sense, it's in that sense that I claim that the time of plants is the time of the other. But then, of course, there are seemingly conflicting moments within that. On the one hand, we have this infinite and seemingly linear temporality of growth, that simple augmentation. And that, by the way, has been also thought of as a kind of deficiency, both by Aristotle and by Hegel, because for Hegel, this linear temporality of growth is a figure of bad infinity, a kind of infinite series that does not complete the circle and does not return to itself. So even there, plants have provided fodder for the for metaphysical critique of their time. And then the other aspect that clashes with this is the cyclical time of reproduction and iteration and repetition. It is this conjunction of the three kinds of time, the time of the other, the infinite temporality of growth, and the cyclical temporality of reproduction that I focus on. As for the freedom of plants, this is really, we have actually broached this topic insofar as we talked about the way that about plant plasticity, the way that plants respond to the environment, and they're not really, and in fact they are what the environment makes them, much more than the animals, right? Because they respond to such an extent to environmental factors such as the amount of sunlight and so on. So they are freed in that sense from the organismic totality, as we mentioned, right? They are free to develop in these ways that are more unpredictable than the development of an animal organism. At the same time, they are freed from what I would call the constraints of identity, so that that their subjectivity, which is more anonymous, which does not really know the hard and fast differentiation between the self and the other, I see that not as a sign of underdevelopment or under or a kind of lack or deficiency, but as a promise actually for plant ontology, a promise to free them from a preset identity and to become other to themselves, so they can produce another plant, or they can mutate, as it were, at the more abstract level. Their kind of soul, nourishment and reproduction, can mutate into what we think of as the subjectivity of animals and that of humans as well. So this basic stratum of subjectivity and of life is not just is never left behind. It is free to become other to itself, as it were, in including its repercussions in us human beings as well.
So one of the things I'm thinking of as you're talking was, I thought of bonsai trees, for example, you know, a case where I sort of wondered where there does seem to be more of a subjectivity than for you know, just your plants out, you know, out in the open. And maybe again, this is just an extremely good illustration of what you just said about the dependence of the subjectivity on the environment, since it's certainly not the tree itself that forms itself into its shape, but it's purely a result of what we do to it.
Yes, yes, exactly. And this, yes, absolutely. I agree with you, Carrie. And in this category, we would have to include everything related to cultivation as well, right? And we know that we have co-evolved with cereals that were cultivated since the dawn of humanity, let's say, wheat and rice and so on. So it would be difficult to even separate us from those plants that we have cultivated. We have been cultivating for millennia because the influence, once again, has been double. It is not just that we have cultivated these crops, but they have, at the genetic level, altered us as well, right? So in that sense, cultivation can certainly be taken as a sign of a diminished freedom of plants, but then there sort of subjectivity erupts where we least expect it, right? How is it that a stalk of rice would change human genetic makeup, but this is really the case. So, so in that sense, cultivation, the transformation of plants, and the channeling of their growth has been a kind of root of culture, of human culture itself, right? And we tend to think of culture in relation to particular plants that are cultivated, for instance, especially wheat and the wines, right? They are, oh, yeah. Bread and wine are the archetypal symbols of culture, right? So so yes, much of what we think of as of our own culture is also a transformation within vegetal life that we ourselves have affected, but we continue to be affected by it as well in ways that are not maybe consciously or completely intended by us.
Yeah, so maybe we should get to the final sort of aspect that you focus on, which is the wisdom of plants, and to the nature of plant thinking itself, or as you also call it, rhizomatic thought. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could just say a word about rhizomatic thought, and maybe as you also mentioned that we should get accustomed to the idea that thinking is not just the sole prerogative of a subject or mm-hmm. or of a human being.
Yes. So I would say that in this sense, rhizomatic thought is very much akin to what I call modular intelligence, which is a kind of dispersed intelligence or dispersed sensitivity and attunement to the environment. In this sense, we can think of a mode of thinking that does not involve either ideation or representation or even cognition in the way that we attribute these to human beings. So the underlying sort of goal or aim would be to say that human thinking is an example of thinking in general. It is not the gold standard of thought, but it is one mode in which we can think about thinking. And the thinking of plants could well be another mode which in many ways interacts with us and on which we rely as well, but which is also distinct from our mode of thinking. So generally speaking, this is what I would include under this category of rhizomatic thought.
Well, what is then, on your view, this sort of thinking in general before we get to the... So, in other words, if there's a thinking, mm-hmm. And then of which, say, the cognitive or representational thought of a human being is one species, mm-hmm. and the non-cognitive, you know, non-representational mm-hmm. Mode of plants is a different one. I mean, a lot of people would say, well, you're just, you know, kind of using the word thinking in a very strange sort of way. So I think it would be helpful if you kind of maybe gave us some insight into how you understand thinking such that it makes sense to talk about these two different modes of thinking as modes of the same general activity.
Sure. So what I have in mind is a kind of recovery of the insights of ancient philosophy. As we know, for the ancients, starting with Parmenides, being and thinking were the same. So there was no clear differentiation between the two, and different modes of being involved corresponding modes of thinking. All of that figures very clearly within the rich tradition of philosophies of immanence that started with Plotinus and then went all the way to through Spinoza and Leibniz to Nietzsche, Bergson, and Deleuze. So there's this whole rich tradition of philosophies of immanence that within which this makes a lot of sense. For Plotinus in particular, his idea was that everything and everyone in the world amounts to emanations of the One. And plants express or think the One, and he uses this word, noesis, think the One in growing and reproducing. So they think the One in its growing and reproducing aspect. And in fact, I would say in retrospect that plant thinking is to some extent a translation of the Plotinian futiki noesis, which is usually translated as growth thinking. But as we know, plants, the Greek word for a plant, which is phuto, is the same as the word for growth, right? So plant thinking or growth thinking is already something that Plotinus thought about. Of course, I want to subtract the One from this equation, without the sort of plant thinking without the One is what I'm up to here. And so if we follow this tradition of philosophies of immanence all the way to the 19th and 20th century in Nietzsche, Bergson, and Deleuze, then we can also loosen the categorical distinction between thought and matter. As well, so that things become matters of gradation. These distinctions between thinking and non-thinking become matters of gradation, as opposed to just matters of absence or presence of thinking in that sense.
Okay, so let me ask you something about how we interact with plants. So, I mean, it's kind of the overarching goal of the book, as I understand it, is not just to provide a sort of new perspective and new valuation of the nature of plants, and to emphasize, you know, the differences, and also give them and also the positive fact nature of these differences between plants and animals. How does your meditation, how do these affect our interactions with plants? I mean, one of the questions that I had as I immediately started reading was, can we eat them? For a vegetarian, of course, or a vegan, this is a critical issue. And so, obviously you don't say, we shouldn't be eating plants either. One of the issues was, how should we as individuals, as human beings, relate to plants? I mean, is it still an ethical matter to be eating plants? And then the wider sense of, the violence that we do, if that's the right word, to plants in terms of altering their genetics, patenting seeds and so forth. These are other ways of kind of interfering with vegetal life in a way that's using them as very instrumentally, completely instrumentally. And then there's, I guess, the broader one that you bring up in the very beginning of the book, and that you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, was the whole broad environmental crisis that we're in. So maybe if you could address each of those sort of more ethical issues and how your perspective on plants might inform each of those, the issue of you know, eating them, the issue of interfering with their own sort of growth patterns and nature, and then in the broader context of how we treat the environment.
Right. Yes. So these are all crucial points, and I touch on them briefly in this book, in Plant Thinking, and in the sequel to this book titled Provisionally, Plant Doing, The Ethics and Politics of Vegetal Life, I actually go very much more in depth into all of these issues and try to work out a coherent ethical approach, which would be consistent with this revaluation of plants. But yes, these are all central issues. The issue of eating plants, of course, is raised very often. And the less sympathetic readers sort of think that that my position would prevent people from ethically consuming any plants or any of their plant products. This is not at all the case, because the idea is that plant being is a kind of constant self-giving. And so there could be various ways of interacting with plants through nutritionally that do not that do not kill the entire plant, and more importantly, that do not produce whole communities of plants for the only for the sole purpose of eating them. So, as I see, the problem is not so much in eating this or that particular plant, but in having so much disrespect toward the being of plants that that they are produced only for the purpose of consumption. So, as you mentioned, Kerry, this a totally instrumentalizing attitude is the problem for me, and it would involve not only individual choices, but even more importantly, a kind of a collective decision on how agriculture should be structured, and a collective reorganization of human relation to plants around these dietary issues. I think very recently, I think just a week ago or so, there was an article on the BBC about plants as the green machines and what needs to be done to increase the productivity of the crops to feed growing human populations. But I think the very, of course, the problem is there, and it's a very important problem. But the very framing of it is wrong, and this is where philosophers can come in and inform public discussion, I think, not just saying that there is this problem of the growing human populations, and we should just intensify the violence we have been channeling toward plants, and that has backfired upon many human beings as well, including farmers, that we should intensify it in order to solve the population problem. This is not sufficient, and this is going to lead us to a greater disaster, I think. And so nothing short of an ethical reorganization of agriculture would suffice here, which would be informed by this idea that plants cannot be completely instrumentalized, that we have to respect their mode of being. And this brings me to this idea of patented seeds in particular, which is a big problem insofar as the seeds that are patented by corporations such as Monsanto are sterile, so that the farmers are forced to buy them year in, year out. They are not the crops that grow out of these seeds are not going to produce seeds that can be replanted. So not only does this sort of commercial practice rob plants of their own potential, of what has defined their potential for being for millennia ever since Aristotle, the potential to reproduce, but it also robs the farmers of their means of subsistence, because they have traditionally relied all over the world on seed gathering practices that would allow them to replant the seeds. So this is one example in which the violence against plants and the violence against human beings go hand in hand and feed one another, as it were, in that sense. Mm-hmm. And then finally, you raised the problem of the environmental crisis. And as I mentioned in the beginning of our interview, I see the meditation on plants as a kind of concrete entry point into the question of the environment. Because if we speak and think of the environment as a whole, then we create this abstract entity which hovers somewhere in midair in discourses, but with which we cannot really identify. We cannot point to the place of our where we live, to our gardens, to our fields, and say this is the environment, right? These are all parts and small bits and pieces of the environment. But if we think about plants, then we can gain this entry point into the environment, or into what we call nature, for that matter. And we can think of new modes of relating to the environment and to nature and to plants through this kind of rethinking of what the plants are and what they can do as well.
So let me just ask somewhat of a challenging question, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So plants, they don't have the sort of subjectivity that we think of as, you know, as a subject. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, well, you know, how much, you know, other than a very sort of, there's different ways in which one can respect either a plant or the environment as a whole. Mm-hmm. And one way doesn't really change the attitude towards it, which is just, we need this for ourselves to keep our own existence going. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we have to treat it better because, you know, that's, you essentially haven't, I mean, one has not essentially changed one's attitude towards it. It's mm-hmm. still a matter of sort of, we need this, so we better take
yes.
care of it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the sort of respect towards something that we have as a subject, to use that word again, mm-hmm. of, you know, ethical respect, you know, being treated in a certain way.
Yes.
And I was just wondering, I mean, the terms respecting and, you know, subjectivity can be used in, you know, in both those sort of different ways. And mm-hmm. I was just wondering which do you think that your work will, is it necessary to promote one particular way of approaching things, of approaching plants, of approaching the environment, you know, given what you say about the nature of plants, or, you know, is it just that we've got a particular perspective, maybe we can learn to treat the environment and treat plants better, but mm-hmm. whether we adopt the respect in the sense of, you know, towards a separate subject is really mm-hmm. not all that critical, and especially may not even be possible given that there is no subject there in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is, of course, a great question, Carrie. But what comes to mind is, of course, the philosophy of Immanuel Kant, right? For Kant, only persons could be respected and not things, right? So, of course, there is a gap there. Where do animals fit? And then plants, of course, they are not really things and they are not quite persons.
Right.
But if we dig a little bit deeper into Kant's philosophy, Kant did not think that human beings should be respected simply because they are living beings, because there is a living human being, it's deserving of respect. What is respectable in us is our transcendental subjectivity, is the fact that we're capable of reason and so on and so forth. It's not our bodily constitution, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. The materiality of the human being is not an object of respect for Kant. So to begin with, for a very long time, we have not been able to respect a very important part of ourselves, which is the embodied material aspect of our existence. And this is where our existence intersects with that of plants, right? Mm-hmm. This sort of unconscious kind of life, the visceral and embodied reality of living beings has been always excluded from the purview of respect, including in Kant himself. So I would say that if we learn to, even though this sounds like a very tall task to accomplish, if we learn to respect plants as subjects, as unconscious subjects with their own kind of freedom, time, thinking, and so on, then perhaps we would also learn to respect what has been always denigrated in ourselves, which is this material, embodied, crude aspect of our existence. And so So I see it as an essential point to say that plants are subjects, and that is why they're deserving of respect. And there are different kinds of subjectivity, including the unconscious subjectivity in us, that have not been respected either. In traditional Western philosophy, and so I see this as a bundle of issues that go together. Mm-hmm. If we learn to respect plants as subjects, then perhaps we will learn to respect the unconscious and material subjectivity in ourselves as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of goes back to Plato, or mm-hmm. at least go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. In Plato, we have this first sort of dramatic inversion of the whole question of life with regard to the plant, because Plato actually thinks of human beings, and Timaeus, he says this clearly, the human being is a celestial plant. And how so he draws that identity between plants and humans, but at the same time differentiates between them. What does it mean to say that humans are celestial plants? And he explains, humans have their roots growing out of their heads and connecting us to the world of ideas above us. Mm-hmm. So we are plants upside down, right? Or plants are humans upside down, which regarding, depending on the perspective you assume. And our soil and our ground to which we are bound, tethered through these cognitive roots, is the world of ideas, is the eidetic realm. And then plants and everything in the material world is just the upside down image of that, and something, of course, that is devalued and disrespected as a result, because of their lack of ties to the world of ideas.
Okay, so we're running short on time, and I guess before we end, you mentioned a new book that you're working on called which I think you said Plant Doing. So I wanted to, I did want to ask what your next project is, if you are following up this book with another one, which apparently is the case, or if there's other avenues of research that you're pursuing.
Yes, there are actually several avenues, and this book that I have mentioned, Plant Doing, is one of them. One of the next book that is actually coming out from Columbia University Press next year is titled The Philosopher's Plant, an Intellectual Herbarium. And it was really a fun book to write based on my research for plant thinking, but I intended it as a kind of introduction to philosophy through the figure of plants, so that mm-hmm. from Plato to the 20th and 21st century, and culminating in the work of Lucy Irigaray, I have lined up 12 different key philosophers and associated them with one figure of a plant that they either discuss explicitly or simply mention in passing in their work, and introduce their own ideas, both on plants and on their main philosophical insights, through that very delimited, that very concrete instance of talking about a particular plant. So that book, which is actually a collaboration with the French artist Mathilde Russell, who produced fantastic drawings for it, is going to be out in 1 year's time. And in the meanwhile, I'm also working on Plant Doing, as I mentioned, and in parallel writing a book I titled Phytophenomenology, The Plants Being in the World, which is really a meticulous phenomenological description very much aligned with the research in plant sciences of what it means for plants to be in the world, to relate to a place or to construct a place, to relate to other beings or to communicate with them, and so on. So these are the different avenues and branchings out that plant thinking has taken in the meanwhile.
Well, it all sounds fascinating. I mean, I look forward to the next book and the one after that. But I think at this point we're out of time, so I need to stop. But thank you very much for a very fascinating book and an illuminating interview about plants.
Yes, thank you very much for a wonderful interview, Carrie.
Okay, bye bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Martyr,
Ickerbach Research Professor of Philosophy at the University of the Basque Country in the Basque Autonomous Region of Spain. We've been talking about his new book, Plant Thinking, A Philosophy of Vegetal Life, just out from Columbia University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you again for listening.